Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A happy Labor Day to each and every one of you. And thank you so much for listening today. This morning, around breakfast time, I was out on our front porch and I was reading the paper. And I'm hearing a bird song and I could not for the life of me identify that bird. And it was driving me crazy. And I thought, why don't I have Bill Volkert or Noel Cutright sitting next to me, because those guys always know. Oh, my goodness. They're with us today, and maybe they can help you identify a bird, or maybe they can explain to you something about migration, or maybe they can tell you about a particular bird you might have seen if you can identify it and give us a pretty good indication of what it looked like. They might be able to identify it, but they're always great. And they always do a wonderful job, and they come with us, I think, every holiday, pretty much. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, are you there?
I'm here, Larry. What would you have served me for breakfast if I'd been there?
Well, I tell you what, I had a couple of eggs, and I made a sandwich out of them.
Hey, sounds good to me.
And a little bacon and a banana.
Wonderful.
And Bill Volkert, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Bill, you'd have gotten the same thing.
Well, that would have been an easy trade-off. Identify a bird for breakfast. You're on.
Well, we may have some folks who have questions about birds. And, of course, I can never recreate the song. But that's all right.
Really what makes it difficult for us to get a bit of an ear for them and to try to even explain or convey that is because it's so hard for us to imitate most of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it a little bit difficult. It's a foreign language that we have to learn.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, if you're listening in, you have a question about birds or about bird migration or what's going on in your neighborhood with your birds, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you've got a photograph of a bird that you can't identify, maybe we can look at the Facebook page and figure it out for us. Then that's just at The Larry Mueller Show. So all those ways to get to us. I'm wondering, guys, I expect birds have been affected by this year's drought to some extent. What kinds of effects might they have had? Bill, start with you.
Well, I think probably most people, especially in southern Wisconsin, would have realized this was a year where you could walk in the woods and right down to the edge of the wetlands in just short sleeves, T-shirt, and shorts. The mosquitoes have hardly been even present out there.
Right.
And now, mosquitoes are not a major food source for most birds. It's a pretty tiny insect. And, of course, our big mosquito hour really happens right around dusk when most birds become inactive. But as the same result where mosquitoes are down, no doubt a lot of other insect populations were down. So now does that mean that either adult birds were not able to get enough nutrition, enough protein for egg production in the first place? Was it that perhaps there was even starvation of young? It's really hard to quantify because we just can't watch enough of these nests and really keep a good eye on it. But I think we could certainly infer that that lack of food was no doubt going to translate in a little bit more difficult time for nesting season for birds this year, especially in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, you'd agree with that, I expect, Noel.
Yeah, and I think, you know, deer flies are really scarce, too. They depend upon water, and I think I only saw 3 or 4 deer flies all summer. But based upon what I'm seeing around my yard this, you know, late summer, early fall, production of some of the birds, at least, were awful. I've never seen so many goldfinches that I've seen this year. And woodpeckers seem to have a really wonderful year of production. So there's no question that some species probably carried on as well, if not better than ever. But, it's a case-by-case example, and it's hard to quantify.
Yeah. Well, Martina in Green Bay has a comment. Hi, Martina. Thanks for calling.
How are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Good. Well, I just have, I guess, a comment and any information that I could glean from your guest.
Okay.
I think, anyway, I've identified this little bird as a bush tit.
Okay.
And it showed up in my backyard summer before last. I didn't see him last summer, but he was back this summer. And I just noticed him right away because he had this very distinct, loud little chirping sound that I hadn't heard in my backyard before. And then I just saw this little tiny, tiny brownish-gray bird, smaller than a wren or a finch even,
Mm-hmm.
And he's just got a funny little habit. He bounces around all over the place. He uses a tiny, tiny birdhouse that we have that no other bird can get into. And when the babies come out, they all kind of congregate once they come out of the house, and they hang upside down on the fences. They're just so much fun to watch, and beautiful bird song. So I just wondered if I could have any more information about the little bird.
Okay.
Well, there's certainly never been a bush tit in Wisconsin. This is a bird that's restricted to the western area from, you know, northern Mexico. They do range up along the coast all the way to Washington. So they're...
That's what I heard, but I did read that. But then I read that every once in a while they'll show up in the suburbs in different states. So I'll take the rest of my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
As far as I know, there's never been one seen east of the Mississippi, so I don't think it's a bush tit. You know, there's not that many species that use a nest box. And of course, the most common in your backyard would be a house wren, but you seem to know what a house wren looks like. So the other bird that doesn't nest in a house but is somewhat similar in shape because they do have a long tail and they're gray as a blue-gray gnatcatcher. But they're not really loud. They're not loud songsters. But house wrens certainly are. Bill, do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, I even had to look up bush tit here just to see if there's something similar. I hadn't seen them in a couple of years since I was out west doing some birding. And, yeah, I don't know of any record for Wisconsin. You know, tufted titmouse is fairly distinct with its markings, about the same size, though. You know, one thing about bush tit is it's just so nondescript. And I don't know of anything as cavity nester that we would have here.
Yeah, both really tit mice and chickadees will nest in cavities,
yeah.
Obviously.
But they've got pretty distinctive marks that should stand out.
Correct.
If she could get a photo, that would be the ideal, wouldn't it?
Sure would.
A thousand words, yeah.
Yeah. If you get a, keep your camera around, if you can get a photo, that would be absolutely wonderful. If you get one, please send it in. We'll get it identified for sure.
Especially if it's hanging around a bird house where it's somewhat predictable that it might come around, that might be a good chance for a photo.
Yeah. And let's go to Mary in Bayside next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Yes. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two things, actually. First, I wanted to say thank you to Bill. This is Mary Francis with the Chickadees. We have a website and a music trio, and we help kids identify birds and their backyard wildlife, things like that. And he was very helpful. I posted some things on our website, and I wasn't quite sure of. So thank you so much for helping me identify some birds I didn't know.
Oh, you're certainly welcome.
And second, I was walking the dog the other day, and I heard this call, and it sounded exactly like, do you remember the Woody Woodpecker show?
Yep.
It was like, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah. Yep.
Exactly like that. And I could not spot the bird, and I tried to research woodpecker songs, and I couldn't find it. Is this actually a woodpecker, or am I crazy?
Well, Woody Woodpecker was taken from the pileated or pileated woodpecker, which is the largest woodpecker that we have in Wisconsin. So it does have a really loud cackling sound. The flicker, which is also a woodpecker, has a fairly similar vocalization. It's not as robust, but they will do this repeated kind of a kak-kak-kak-kak-kak-kak. So you will hear that sound. And from a distance, sometimes pileated and flicker, you've got it's a little hard to discern. It's more that little bit deeper and much more robust, much more almost a bellowing to the pileated, being a much larger bird. So, yeah, the cartoon character came from a real bird, from our pileated woodpecker. And, well, the cartoon did take off a little bit on the call. It's not completely exact, but close enough.
Close enough.
Yeah, it was odd because it sounded exactly like that. And I thought, someone is playing a joke on me. But I'm looking around. I can't find the bird. So I will look up those two woodpeckers and see if I can.
Sure, and our pileated woodpecker is a bird of the deeper in forest interior. So they need a bigger stands of mature trees. But the birds have been doing quite well in the state. They seem to be spreading out a little bit more and showing up in more places. Populations have been increasing. And again, flickers are found throughout the entire state.
Right. We're right by the Audubon Center, so possibly.
Oh, could well be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the information.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary, for calling. And Rachel, in Madison, we are going to turn to you next. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The other night, Saturday, we were up walking at Indian Lake County Park, just north of Madison. And it was, I don't know, about 5 o'clock, overcast. We went to look for birds. We noticed when we got there, it was sort of eerily quiet. There were very few birds. We were really hard to see any birds flying around, couldn't hear any. And then shortly after we arrived, we saw a couple osprey fishing, which was, you know, quite a thrill, circling and actually dropping into the water for fish. And we wondered if there was a connection there, if the songbirds somehow make themselves scarce when the larger birds are around. It seems like osprey are fish catchers, so we didn't know if that was the case or was it just maybe a coincidence.
Yeah. Noel?
I think it was a coincidence. I don't think there's any relationship between quiet and the presence of raptors, for example, especially osprey.
Mm-hmm. Although around my bird feeder.
Oh, yeah. When the Cooper's hawk is around, birds around feeders certainly, or sharp-shinned hawk, too, that they'll recognize their presence and really shut up and remain very quiet.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they are a direct threat to songbirds. That's what they will hunt, unlike osprey, as we indicated here, is a fish eater. There's no real threat, and they don't seem to respond to it, but they sure know their enemies. In fact, that one of my interesting experiences with Cooper's hawk was, I recall a number of years ago working at my desk at home, right out the window was a bird feeder, and anytime I glanced up, something was coming and going, and off in the distance, I didn't register right away. I heard this little screech of a songbird, I heard another one closer, and then I heard something out in front. And as fast as I could look up, the bird feeder was empty, and a split second later, Cooper's hawk sailed by. You could literally hear the birds through the woods, one after another, screaming, hawk, next one, hawk, and everybody responded, headed for cover, and before he got here, it was just vacant. So, yeah, they watch from a long distance, and they really will warn each other with vocalization, too.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Rachel. Appreciate your call. And Stephen Appleton, hi.
Hey, good morning. The question I have, I live in a rural area around Appleton, and I'm not sure on the months here, you might have to help me out, but let's say April, May, and June at 4:45 when the sun first starts coming up and 5 o'clock, 5:15, whatever time it is, you know, the birds are so loud in the morning that it almost wakes you up. And then in July and August, it almost dies off. It's so quiet. I'm like, where do they go? Is it the robin because they're breeding and now they've gone farther north, or they've nested and raised their young and they're gone? Or why does it get so quiet and sometime in July and now in August, and it's so loud in May and June in the morning?
Hmm.
Well, the main reason for them calling and singing in springtime is to attract the mate and to kind of solidify that pair bond. So both to get a mate and hang on to a mate and claim that territory. Once you get well into the nesting season, there's no reason to do it. They've got the mate, they're raising a family, and you might want to be a little quieter to not attract attention to the nest and the young at that time. So in springtime, that's that courtship period. That's that time to establish your territory and settle down, grab your own piece of land, and hopefully get a mate. And once they're into the nesting season and start initiating it, they become much more quiet, much more reclusive, because, of course, not only is there no need to attract the mate, but now those young are tied to the nest and they're very vulnerable. You don't want to bring too much attention to it.
So there is definitely I'm not just imagining this. It's something that's happening.
No, not at all.
It's an annual trend, and once we get into that nesting season, the birds really start to quiet down.
I missed the noise.
Yeah.
And the other question, And the turkey, you know, I ride up my bike a lot, and I see the turkey growing up, and they're getting bigger and bigger. Now, when do they get kicked out? When does mom say, see you later, to the baby turkey?
Well, turkeys, they raise what we call precocial young, so the day that they hatch, they're fully feathered, and they're running around. And the parents, rather than bringing food to the young, take them to the food and are more like guardians. They'll keep watch of those young until they get into this now late summer, fall. They may remain with the same parents or start to form other sorts of flocks. So the turkeys do flock up, whether they're actually with their own nest mates and parents later in the year, or just reshuffle it and join others of their kind because they're no longer dependent on the parents. There is that flocking going on into the winter period, and there may be a reshuffle among, say, family members even.
And I think with turkeys this year, I've seen a wider range of young than I've just about seen any year I can remember. The first broods, I think, started early, and they hatched out and grew, and those that lost their first clutch of eggs probably re-nested.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been that long ago that I was still seeing turkeys that were only the size of, you know, really small chickens. And another thing, I think the drought may have actually helped them with the grasshopper population. I think there's a tremendous grasshopper population this year, and that's certainly a favorite food for turkey poults.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Thank you very much for that question. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, one of our guests, the other, Bill Volker, naturalist and retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, back from her labors in the country of Canada. With us, great to see her smiling face again. And great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. On this Labor Day, we're taking a look at birds and fall migration with our two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volker. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. You can join us, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post a photo or you can post a question there. We'd love to hear from you at the Larry Mueller Show. And we do have a couple of things on our Facebook page. One from Ryder says, every night we hear a bird that we believe to be an owl screeching, one screech at a time, all night long. What type of owl do you suppose this is? My thoughts are a juvenile great horned, but I am just guessing.
It's a good guess.
Yeah?
I think that's what it is. You know, this is the time of year that, you know, great horned owls have been out of the nest for a while, but they still would like to have their parents bring them some food. So they'll perch in a conspicuous spot and do this wheezy screech during the night.
And, you know, I think we have, I know we have that. Judith located it for me. I think we've got both an adult and then we'll hear the juvenile great horned owl. So let's give a listen. That'll get your attention.
That's it.
That's that wheezy call of the young, and they will go into sometimes even November, early December. It's a begging call. There's a long period for them to rear those young, and some of the young just don't give up easy and just try to hunt on their own. And I know this has come up in past programs, especially this time of year, so I'm glad we had a recording because that's one that catches a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And Erin in La Crosse has a question for you. So let's go to her. Hi, Erin. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering about native species that I can plant that would provide food for the birds, you know, through the winter, but also during the growing season. Our neighborhood, we're kind of in between the marsh and the Black River. And a lot of times my backyard is just overrun by sparrows. We don't see a lot of anything else. So I'm wondering if there's anything else I could be doing to get some different species into the yard.
Well, a couple of things I would suggest is, first of all, stick with the native shrubs. Some of the nurseries still sell some of the ornamentals. There have been attempts to try to lure them away from the honeysuckle, buckthorn, the real invasives. They do provide food, but, of course, they are very invasive in the environment. So bearing-producing shrubs such as the dogwoods, gray dogwood, silky dogwood, those are nice, the elderberries. They both provide dense shelter and nesting sites for birds like cardinals and catbirds that use those thickets. And at this time of year, a great food source for them. Conifers, a couple of the real dense spruces, those are good winter shelter. It's not much for food, but it's good shelter. So those work well. And I know there's a number of publications out there, including Carol Henderson from Minnesota DNR, put out a series of books on bird houses, feeders, and shelters, and also on the different shrubs and trees and bushes that are beneficial. And I think you might want to take a look there to see something that matches your soil type and also kind of complements what you already have in your backyard for landscaping.
There's also an excellent book published a few years called Birdscaping in the Midwest by Mariette Nowak. It's a guide to gardening with native plants to attract birds. It was published, I believe, in Madison area by Itchy Cat Press.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a lot of color, a lot of information. It's available for, I guess, Itchy Cat Press is in Blue Mounds for $27. I'm sure you can find it online, but it's like over a 300-page book that just has a wealth of information on how to birdscape your garden.
Perfect.
Okay. Did a wonderful
Thank
job
you.
With that book.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Kurt in Swamico. It's your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. That owl screech made me lift right out of my chair. I wasn't ready. I have been having a silverback pileated woodpecker show up at my feeders now kind of regularly, and I didn't even know there was such a thing, and it's a pretty big one. Can you tell me, are they common? We're in a pretty good stand of old timber here, so we get all of them.
It's a species, as we're getting more woodlands in Wisconsin, it's expanding its numbers. It's increasing about 5% per year over the last 30 or 40 years, and we're seeing them, you know, much more common now in more agricultural areas where there are still woodlots and other wooded areas becoming more dominant. So it's not an uncommon bird at all, and certainly in the Suamico area, pileated woodpeckers should be, you know, fairly common. You should be seeing them.
And the silverback, too?
Well, I'm not sure what you refer to as silverbacked.
It has a red crest, but the rest of it is silvery gray, I suppose. I sent a picture to the talk at WPR and as an attachment. I don't know if you can still do that, Larry.
Yeah, we can, but unfortunately today, for some reason, we got a hard drive problem, so we're working on it. Haven't been able to get emails up.
Well, possibly the melatonin, which is one of the pigments that's responsible for the real dark color, maybe it's a little bit lacking in that particular individual, so it makes the back look, you know, more silvery. But, you know, they should have a pretty dark back. It's not, I guess, a true black, but it's close to black.
Oh, yeah. No, the other ones that come around are have the black and the white, of course, but this one is silvery gray. And it's quite pretty, actually.
I'd love to see a picture of it, but I would say it's just a pigmentation issue.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll send it to the Facebook if I can figure out how to work that.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. All right. Jim and Van Dyne, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
First of all, you were talking about the great horned owls, and a few years ago when I built this house here, the first winter, I was able to watch a pair about 100 feet from here up in a tree, and that young chick probably hatched around the second or third week of February, and he was out and on his own on tax day on the 15th of April already. And the hardest blowing cold winds, you thought, hey, how would he ever survive? And he sure did, so it was really a treat. The reason I called is the other day I found a large hawk dead near the road, and it may have been hit, but I don't know that. Nonetheless, What I'm looking at and I'm asking is the difference between a Cooper's hawk and a red tail, and if a red tail hawk, when they're young, don't have the red tails yet, because this one, to my view, looked to be young, but it did not have the red tail. So I'm curious about what I'm seeing there and the size between those two birds.
Okay, but Bill, do you want to take a shot?
Sure. First of all, the red tail does not get its red tail until it's about 2 to 3 years old, and this is a common mistake a lot of people make. They look for a single field mark. If you see a big hawk with a reddish tail, it's got to be a red tail. Well, that only works for the adults, so we have to look at other identifying marks. But distinguishing red tail from a Cooper's hawk, they are quite distinct, where the red tail is what we refer to as a buteo hawk. It is a soaring hawk, so they've got large rounded wings and a relatively short square tail. And those are designed for hunting technique to either perch and pounce on the prey, so you'll see them sitting in the large trees looking for something, small rodents or rabbits that they can drop down on, or they will be soaring overhead, circling on the winds and the rising air currents, and again, drop down on their prey. Cooper's hawk, like the sharpshinned and goshawk, those three are in what we call the excipitor hawks. These are birds with relatively short wings and long tails, and they run their prey down. So they've got a very fast, rapid wing beat, that tail's used for ruddering and steering, and they will actually run down small birds through the woods and chasing them. So they're completely different design and flight technique. And as a friend of mine described it once, it's almost like the difference between fighters and bombers.
Yeah.
So the tail alone should really help you in terms of the proportionate size of the tail to the body. Cooper's hawk and sharpshin, long, narrow tail compared to the body, where the red tail, that shorter, square tail.
Now, this bird was probably 16 to 18 inches tall. Does a Cooper's hawk get that big?
The large female...
Yes.
They can, from the, you know, the beak to the tail. That's about the upper limit of the size for a bird like that. But they're going to be long and slender, where the red tail is a large, bulky bird. Also,
yeah.
If you see the bird from in front, the red tail tends to have a very whitish breast. When they're young, there's more speckling on it, and then it'll get a slight band across the center of the chest. But it tends to have a fairly whitish, bright background, where the Cooper's hawk has a very grayish speckled breast. And as they become adult, it becomes real fine barring of copper.
Yeah.
Copper okay. color. So they shouldn't be too hard to distinguish the two. If you've got a field guide handy, take a look, and you'll see the distinction. The problem with hawks, of course, is you do have different plumages for young and adult. And especially for the excipitors, if they're just flying by, through the woods and across a highway, you get a quick glimpse. Unless you've got some experience with them, they can be difficult to pick out in a quick shot like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Kenny in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Kenny.
Hello, Mr. Larry Mueller. Nice to be on the show here.
Thanks for joining us. What can we do for you?
Okay, well, here's my story. We had a bird in the yard that we were having some trouble identifying. It kind of was proportioned like a cardinal, but there's something wasn't quite right about its head, and we weren't able to figure it out until we pulled out our camera and took a picture with the zoom lens. And when we zoomed in, we found out that it had no feathers on its head. And so it was kind of freaky, actually, but it turned out, yes, it was a female cardinal. But we're wondering, is it because she had babies? Because we noticed that they had a couple little baby cardinals come out a little later in the summer. And is that common, or is this very strange, rare?
Well, thank you, Kenny, for supplying our annual bald-headed bird question. Like, we get it every year. Cardinals are certainly the species where we see this the most. It's not unusual to see this. And, you know, like in male cardinals especially, they have a very dark pigmented skin. So if there's no feathers there, their skin shows up black. There's still some controversy exactly what causes that. You know, some people think it's feather mites, but whatever it is, it's not harmful to the bird, and they will recover fine, and when they go through the molt, they'll recover those head feathers just fine.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it seemed to be behaving normal, and it was just a different look, and it was just took us by surprise, to say the least.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
And Larry, I noticed somebody posted a picture of that on the Facebook page.
Yeah, we have a... Yes, we do. Well, let's see.
Question came up a little earlier. Somebody else actually caught a picture of a young cardinal with that bald head.
Yeah, and then I went and goofed us up here. So I can't even find my own Facebook page here for a minute now. Oh, why do I do these things? I'm right-handed, and I use my left hand to run the mouse, and sometimes I click where I shouldn't. Oh boy, Cheryl in Washburn, let's turn to you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Larry, Bill, and Joel. How are you doing?
Good.
Great.
I had the pleasure this year in June of having a nest of robins right outside my bedroom window, and it was amazing to watch them feed these four babies and actually fledge them out of there. It was really something to watch. But also this morning I was sitting in my yard and I watched a blue jay come, and it was carrying a full-shelled peanut and basically hid it in an evergreen bush that I have. It was like looking for a spot to tuck it, and then it tucked it in and took it, and then about 2 hours later came back and dug it back out and took off with it. Is that a normal behavior for blue jays?
Not uncommon at all. They love shelled or unshelled peanuts, and like other birds like crows and ravens, they will cache stuff for later on.
Okay.
So, no, it's not uncommon at all. If there's a good supply there, they recognize that, well, maybe in a week I'll be hungry and there won't be any around. So they will proceed to carry them off and try to find good hiding places for them.
It was just pretty cool to watch. I'd never seen anything like that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bill, are you at my Facebook page now?
Yes.
I've got up here that silver pileated woodpecker photo.
Oh, let me do a little refresh here. I was just looking at the question about the big flocks of birds that somebody was seeing as well.
While you're looking at that, I'm going to turn to Kay in Green Bay, and I bet you Noel can talk with Kay. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on the bay in Green Bay. There's woods next to our property. And in springtime, we sometimes hear a bird in the woods, and we're not birders. We don't know what it is, but we call it a yoo-hoo bird because it says, yoo-hoo, yoo-hoo. And we're just wondering if you know what that is.
What do you think, Noel?
Good question.
Is it a whistle or a little bit more hollow?
I think it's more hollow sounding. And it just goes, woo-woo, woo-woo. And it almost sounds like a cuckoo clock. And we've kind of adopted that sound for calling each other in the yard just because it's kind of a fun thing, but we don't know what it is.
We'll put our caps on here for the next hour and see if we can come up with something.
Okay.
We'll probably get some callers calling
probably
in with some suggestions too. So stay listening, Kay.
I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Yeah, the yoo-hoo bird. Let's go to Paul and what? Oh, and by the way, did you get to that silverback yet?
Here it is. Yeah. Okay. Like you, I clicked on the wrong thing and I don't know where I went. So,
tell you what, while you're looking at it,
it's a bit of a dark picture. I wonder if this may not just be either a bit of an aberrant color on the back or perhaps even a young one.
Could be a young one, too.
Because it's not a typical, as Noel mentioned, they're dark in the back normally.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely not normal. Paul in Watertown, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. So the other day, I have a lot of birds around my house, but I saw overhead, it was up pretty high, shaped like a purple martin or a swift bird flying like that. White marks, maybe white circles, one white circle on the bend of each wing. But the silhouette I had looked like a purple martin, you know, seeing it from down below.
Yeah, good description of a common nighthawk.
That's what I was thinking.
Yep, they've really been moving through the state in the last couple of weeks. Some people have seen birds flowing past and, you know, 100 per hour, more than 100 per hour.
Uh-huh.
So this is a time of year that they're moving from their breeding grounds and farther north from here, and really been steaming through in significant numbers, headed all the way for the tropics.
That's cool. That's not related to the whippoorwill or nightjar, is it?
Yes, it is. It is a nightjar.
Oh, it is. Okay,
yes.
But it's not the whippoorwill. It's just a nighthawk, and that's is there only one that's in this area?
Yes, the only one we have is common nighthawk. They nest on the ground or sometimes on rooftops that have a gravel rooftop in small villages.
Mm-hmm.
But they nest on the ground along trails or, say, in barrens areas where you have some bare, unvegetated ground. They'll nest right on the ground and lay their eggs there.
All right. Cool. Thanks. I think I'll draw one now. I'll look it up.
All right. Thank you for calling. Beth in Waukesha, comment from you.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
I wondered if the lady that was talking about the yoo-hoo bird, if that might possibly be a mourning dove.
Yeah, that was actually my first thought.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I see a Facebook page, somebody saying chickadee, which is why I asked whistled. Yeah, mourning dove is possible, that very hollow call. Oh, let's see who else has got a suggestion here.
Could I say one other thing real
sure,
quick?
Sure, you bet.
I've been a birder for about 15 years, and I never seem to be able to keep up with the people that I'm with. They seem to hear more and see more. And for years and years and years, I wanted to see this pileated woodpecker. And I'd be in a park, and I'd be with a friend, and we'd hear this hollow drumming really loud, and, oh, that's it, but we could never see it. And one day, we were up in Door County, right off of Highway 42, getting out of the car. We saw a pileated woodpecker no more than 4 feet from the highway picking at a log that was on the grass right there.
Yeah.
So I was very surprised to find it in a not secluded area, a very busy area, but there he was, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, their primary prey are carpenter ants, so if they can find an old log on the ground,
mm-hmm.
They'll work on it for over an hour sometime. It's just really taking it apart.
Yeah.
That was okay. in Peninsula State Park in Door County. And
right at the entrance to the park is where it was, actually.
Well, there was two years ago, there was a family of pileateds, mom and dad and two young.
Oh.
So the young were right on, I was within 4 feet of the young.
Really?
Yeah, they were right down. They came right down on the ground.
That's a pretty dramatic bird the first time you see it.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Beth, for calling. Appreciate your call. Had a Facebook from Eric about 3 weeks ago, staying with his sister in Appleton around dusk every night. They'd sit out on the patio and they'd see 500 to 1,000 small birds flocking and flying all over the place. Quite a sight to see. They absolutely covered the power lines and nearby tree branches. I have no description, but what there are probably any number of birds those might have been. He's never seen such a large group in one place at a time. What do you think, guys?
Well, my guess would be cedar waxwing.
Oh, yeah.
On power lines, when I read this on Facebook page, power lines, the big numbers of swallows are common, especially the last few weeks. They've been really lining up. But the tree branches might be cedar waxwings. They really flock up in some pretty good numbers. They're gathering up around lake shores, and they are hitting, as their name indicates, the berries for the red cedar trees. They're going after that. So that's probably my first guess, most likely.
And there have been huge numbers of waxwing moving the last couple of weeks. I've seen reports of several reports of waxwings numbering in the hundreds. So we're really seeing a significant movement of them this fall.
And that is a bird that if you've got binoculars handy, get a close look. They've got such a sleek, beautiful plumage. It looks like it's hand-painted. And it's really a bird worthwhile to get a close look at. They're fairly accommodating when they perch like that, and you just need some good lighting and a good close look. So a pair of binoculars, keep them handy and check them out.
Very cool. Bill Volker, naturalist and retired wildlife educator from Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds and fall migration today with Noel Cutright and Bill Volker. Both of these guys are experts. They've been studying birds their whole professional lives and probably before that as well. Bill, I know, has you've cited isn't that more than 2,500 species?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what are there, about 11,000? That's about a quarter of the world's species.
Yes, roughly 10,000 species. And we think we've just about discovered all of the birds known to the planet. I don't think there's something hiding out there that, you know, it looks completely bizarre. We've never seen anything related. More than what we're discovering are more a close analysis of certain populations, which as we reevaluate them, they qualify for species status. They're isolated. They're a little bit different from their close cousins. And this is the problem among ornithologists. It's not easy to always divide those lines where we want. Is it just a subspecies, a variant of something else, or is it a true distinct species? And that's why those numbers are a little fuzzy, and I just rounded off about 10,000. Not everybody can agree on all of them, and that's why these the name changes oftentimes occur, too. As we reclassify birds, not only the scientific names, but the common names change. But, yeah, roughly 10,000 species out there, and I've seen about a quarter of them, which, you know, it's been a nice life that way, but I have to remind myself three-quarters of them are still to be discovered by me. So, I'll run out of time and money before I ever get that far, but it's a great passion, and you can do it anywhere.
Well, and you've been traveling so much. Noel, I don't know if you've traveled as much as Bill has, but I'm sure I've seen your share of birds, too.
Yeah, I really haven't traveled that much. A few foreign countries in Latin America, but not that much, so I really concentrated on the lower 48 for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Cheryl in Milwaukee has a comment. Cheryl, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I had found some birds in my garden a few weeks ago that I cannot identify. And I've looked in every bird book we have and on the web. They had very gray heads and necks with a distinct line for light gray on the top. And then their bodies were grayish, purple with red highlights, and they were about the size of a large finch with a very finch or parrot-like profile. Can you help me?
What do you think, guys?
There were two of them.
that's a tough one.
You're being met with silence here.
Yeah.
They were mystery birds. Well, the closest thing I could find was a pink-sided junco, but the colors were not quite right.
Yeah, pink-sided is a western bird.
Yeah, looks
like pink-sided junco.
Nothing comes to mind, Cheryl. I'm sorry.
Oh,
still working on a
okay.
Hoo-hoo bird too.
Yeah.
So, we got a little bit of time. Let's see if something comes to mind.
All right, thanks, and you might hear you know stay listening for sure. We've got go to the Facebook. If you have a chance to go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't have to be on Facebook or a member of Facebook to look, and I would so urge you to look. There's a couple of, Michael sent us a couple of photos, one of a red-winged blackbird chicks that just hatched, and then about a week later, those same chicks, very cool pictures. Really, and then there's another one, he's got maybe a turkey. Turkey in a tree? That could be as well. Turkeys certainly spend a lot of time in trees.
Yeah, that's turkey in the tree, which is where they roost. And for such a large bird, they can lift themselves off the ground for safe roosting in the evening. I'm also looking at the nestling pictures. The pictures, they're not very well developed, even by the second one. We're just starting to see what we call the little pin feathers. So as far as you know, any real plumage development or any real diagnostic features around the face or head, a little hard to see. But when I look at the very first picture, you can see the nest lining. Looks like it's in cattails. My guess here, maybe swamp sparrow?
Oh, he was saying red-winged blackbirds.
Oh, red-winged blackbird? Yeah, the nest lining looks a little fine, but for what they do, but that's possible the way it's built in there. Possibly red-winged blackbird.
Sue in Appleton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. How are you this morning?
Perfect. Really having a great morning.
wonderful. This is such an interesting program. I wanted to make the comment, my sister over in Nelsonville has had a nest of tufted titmice this summer in her backyard, and five babies at her feeder for like a whole month until they left and are no longer to be seen. But how common is this, Larry, to be seeing these titmice? Sarah's had them there for quite a long time now this year.
Well, let me ask Noel. Noel?
With the species, it's always been here in Wisconsin, and I think in recent years we're seeing some range expansion of titmice. So it's great to have them around where you can watch them, especially when they're nesting in a cavity and you can watch them attend to young and so forth. So
yeah,
it's to be expected.
That is really exciting. I didn't realize that. And every time I talk to my sister over there, she'd say, oh, there they are. They're at the feeder. And I'd go, like, take a picture, take a picture. Oh, I can't get the camera out. And then they'd be gone. So we went like this the whole time, and I never got a chance to see them. But that is really exciting.
Thank you for calling, Sue.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Joan in Williams Bay. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
I have three birds I'd like to ask that I've sighted that I'd like to ask about. And that is, the first one is the unusual one. It was two peacocks. I'm in Williams Bay, and I spotted them crossing the road when I was driving. And I don't know where they came from or if you know about anyone who's raising them. Or
well, that sounds like escapees from someplace, eh?
They're gorgeous.
Yeah.
But number two, two sandhill cranes in Elkhorn that hover around the athletic gym there, the Four Lakes Athletic Gym. They got some nice wild stuff outside on the grounds, and they just blend right in with that stuff. I mean, you can hardly see them. And is that a common bird around here? And third, a yellow bird. A black-winged yellow bird, maybe it's a warbler, that my neighbor has in her birdhouse, and I love to watch it. It comes back, you know, from time to time, and we don't know what it is. We try to find it, can't find out. Can you help me with those?
Well, several people raise peacocks, and they do escape. You know, there's no restrictions on owning them or where they are, since they're not a native species. Sandhill cranes are quite common in Wisconsin these days, and this time of year you'll see the pair or maybe the pair and a youngster hanging out together. So, and they're all the way down into Illinois now. So seeing them in the southern part of the state is not unusual. They'll be migrating later this fall. They're pretty late migrants. Sometimes they'll hang around till weather really gets harsh or we get a good snowfall. So it's not uncommon to see them into November. A black-winged yellow bird, the most common one we have right now would be an American goldfinch, but they do not nest in cavities or in boxes. I don't know of any yellow bird that we have here in Wisconsin that nests in a box.
Hmm. I don't.
Well, this was in a bird cage. And I mean in a bird feeder. Bird
oh, at a bird feeder.
Feeder. Yeah.
Oh.
You said bird house, so.
Oh, okay, bird feeder. Oh, okay.
American goldfinch.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right. There you go. Thanks very much for calling, Joan. And Lynn in Evansville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you very much for the show, Larry, Bill, and Noel. Say, I have kind of an elementary owl question. I thought I understood or heard that owls have special feathers allowing for silence in flight, which I would seem provides a hunting advantage for night hunting. But last night I was outside late at night, and there's a woods near my home, and I'm hearing this very loud whoof, whoo, whoo, which seems kind of counterproductive because it's revealing their presence, probably hunting. And I'm wondering, what's the point? Is it to cause unnerve their prey and cause some movement so that they can then swoop in? Why does that work as a hunting tactic?
Well, it's not really a hunting tactic. The hooting is communication. So you may have, as the recording was earlier, of the adult hooting that we'll hear in December, January, February, as the adults are establishing nesting territory, and there will be communication between pairs throughout that whole period when they're nesting and rearing young, and it may even be the young calling from a bit of a distance just to stay in contact.
Even at night. Okay.
Sure. So right now you've got this post-nesting period. The young are out of the nest. Their parents are trying to get them on their own. And there's a little communication going on. And there's also a little shuffle in the population as those young eventually disperse and set up their own territory to settle down for winter and grab their own little piece of land to try to get enough food and secure that. So, yes, they are hunting in the evening. Doesn't mean that they're spending every minute pursuing prey. And there's also communication among individuals or between young and the parents as well. So, yeah, to make a lot of noise would not be real productive if they're hunting. But, you know, they take a little time off, too.
And
off the break.
And you are correct about their wings, because they have like a fringe-like leading edge on their primaries, which are their flight feathers. When a normal bird is flying, the air rushes over the surface of the ring and just it causes turbulence, and that's what you hear kind of as a gushing noise. With an owl's wing, the comb-like feather edge breaks up this turbulence and really muffles the sound.
Mm, very interesting. And how much territory do they need? Do they, you know, 10 acres or 100 acres or...
I think it probably would vary, certainly among the owl, whether it's a little screech owl or a large great-horned or kind of medium-sized barred owl, for one, and then also the density of the prey. Doesn't mean that every woodlot has the same number of, say, rodents per acre.
Oh, sure.
And also keep in mind, a lot of our rodent populations are cyclic. So, like, say, meadow voles tend to have a 4 to 5 year cycle, so you get a buildup and then a crash.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, whether we know almost nothing about them or maybe we've studied them our whole lives, I think birds are very fascinating to almost everybody. Certainly add a lot of enjoyment to my life, and I bet they do to yours as well. And lucky to have a couple of experts today to help us know what we're seeing and hearing. Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, one of our guests. Hi, Noel.
How are you doing, Larry? I guess it's afternoon now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's afternoon, yeah. And Bill Volkert with us, too. He's been studying birds about the same length of time you have, I think about 40 years or so. Bill, thanks again for joining us today.
Always great to join you. Thanks for having us.
Well, I tell you what, on this Labor Day, it's so much fun to talk about birds. And Terry in Milton has a question for you guys, and I want to go there. Hi, Terry, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. I was just wondering, I got a couple of questions here, but I'm watching out the window right now, out of my kitchen window, and I've got a couple pair of ruby-throated hummingbirds, and it's so fascinating to watch these two pairs. A couple of pairs will sit in my, I got some arborvitaes nearby. They'll sit in there and wait for the other two to leave, and then they'll slither up to the feeder and drink, and then the other ones come back and chase them away, and it's back and forth all day long. And I was just wondering where they migrate to.
Sure, that's...
There's a very, very few that overwinter on the Gulf Coast, but the great majority of our ruby-throated hummingbirds head south of there into Mexico and all the way down through Central America. They do not migrate into South America, but Central America is their main wintering range.
That's a long way to go.
Long way to go.
That's for sure.
It sure is. How do they fly? I mean, do they fly relatively low or high or...
Typically fairly low. Sometimes when we're out on hawk watches for hawk movements in the fall, you can see hummingbirds whipping by, and they only may be 20 or 30 feet in the air.
And do they migrate at that same height?
I think most of them are fairly low. They may go higher than that, but I don't think they're really high migrants as some of the larger birds are.
That's very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I was just wondering, guys, if you happen to guys know Holly and Jack Barthamay from the Beaver Dam area.
Yes, both are good friends of mine.
Oh,
and Bill, too.
Yep.
Well, that's fantastic. They're good friends of mine, too, and I've known them since the late 50s. And Jack and I would do a lot of hunting and fishing together. And, of course, Jack would always get more than I would. And they've done a lot of work, and... we keep in contact, but he sends me his calendar of the birds every year, so we keep in touch a little bit anyway.
Yeah.
Jack is a wonderful bird photographer, and he's very gracious in letting other organizations and projects use his photographs. So
yeah, there we go.
Yeah, he sure is. He's a wonderful guy. And when we were young, I mean, we did everything together. Our bicycles had to be exactly alike. And we'd go down the Menominee Parkway, and one incident, we found a bunch of triangular shape. Somebody had cut some wood into triangular shaped pieces, and there were a bunch of ducks out there. And of course, we weren't really concerned about that, but we were just skipping these things across the water, see how far we could get. And Jack flung one, and by golly, he hit right in the neck of one of the ducks.
Oh.
And so we had a duck for dinner.
Oh, man. Well, that's a story you guys are going to have a hard time topping. Thanks a lot for calling, Terry. Appreciate it. All right. We've got Warren online. Has been waiting a while, so let's go to him. Warren, thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks, sir. Yeah, I live by Warner Park, and about 10 years ago, we always had great horned owls, and you could hear them. And the people that were mimicking those sounds did a very, very good job. It's like, one time I was walking through the park, and I saw them on a dead tree. And
yep.
There was like two of them, and they're huge. I remember one time I was walking on a farm in Cedarburg, Wisconsin. We had a farm there. And one time I saw this, it was getting near sunset, and this huge shadow, I was walking through the snow looking for rabbits, this huge shadow, it must have missed my head by about 4 feet. And I'm assuming it was a great horned owl, but it scared the crap out of me. I'm serious. I thought, my God, it's like, it must have missed my head by about 4 feet.
Well, go ahead, Noel.
Can I interject a couple of things here before we run out of time?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to pitch and it relates to one of the caller's questions earlier about how to landscape your area. For the second year, we're holding a workshop on October the 13th called Grouse Beaks Galore. And we're fortunate this year to have Bill as our keynote speaker.
Cool.
And I'll be there, too, so it'll be a chance for your listeners to stop in and hear Bill and meet me and... you can find information on this at www.wisconsinbirds.org. There's a flyer there that gives you registration information. The fee is very cheap. We have a whole morning full of speakers, and in the afternoon we'll be going to the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve for field trips.
Oh, man, that sounds great. And so, and it's how to manage your land for migration stopover habitat, right?
That is correct. Another thing about migration, a wonderful site for people can go and explore is to do a search for Weather Underground, and you can click on NEXRAD radar, and you can actually watch radar at night and get a feeling for what kind of migration of birds, because the birds will show up on NEXRAD radar at night.
Oh, very cool. And, you know, as long as we're talking about, you know, about events, Bill, you are leading a trip to Nicaragua.
Yes, I've been working in Nicaragua for the last 10 years and trying to support their conservation efforts, and I've discovered some wonderful sites down there. It's sort of an untapped area. I know a lot of people who've certainly traveled to Costa Rica, and to try to support some of the private lodges and conservation efforts, I'd like to take a group of birders down there to enjoy the area, explore a little bit, and be able to stay at some of the nice private reserves and visit some of the other natural areas. I've got information, full itinerary is on my website, billvolkert.com, if people want to take a look at it, if they have an interest, and they can contact me straight through that. So we'll be going down to look at the resident birds that live in the tropics, and also a chance in January to see a lot of our migrants, where they overwinter. In fact, last time I was down there, some of the researchers were doing some bird banding and captured ruby-throated hummingbird. So we know those birds are spending the winter down there. And we're looking at those connections. How can they help care for our birds the other half of the year? And let's take a look at where they go to and what are some of the conservation concerns and what are some of the good protection efforts that are going on in Nicaragua. So this will be January 23rd to February 2nd, a birding trip to Nicaragua. We're only taking 10 people, so it'd be a small group. And if people want to join us, just go to my website and check it out.
Very cool. I haven't been to Nicaragua for quite a while. I was in Puerto Cabezas. I spent some time there and spent over on the East Coast and in sort of in the central area, Bonanza. A couple of places that I spent a little bit of time and really enjoyed myself. I'm sure that would be a wonderful trip.
It's a great little country, and I think, as I said, kind of an undiscovered territory, and they could certainly use some of our support for their conservation efforts. They're trying to make some good strides, but, of course, those countries have a lot of other challenges. But it would be fun to explore it and be great to share it with people.
Let's go to Susan in Sheboygan next. Susan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering about the robins. You know, when in the spring there's a lot of robins around, and it just seems like we haven't seen too many robins lately, and wondering if it's something to do with the drought.
No, it's just typical for this time of year. In springtime, you've got the flocks of birds that are coming north, so we have a chance to see large numbers. As they settle in for nesting, they spread out across the land, so it's not uncommon for you and your neighbors to each have a pair in the backyard and rearing the young. And now we're in that post-nesting season. Robins are relatively late migrants, so they're not going to be leaving for a while. But what will happen is now these birds bunch up and are now no longer tied to the nest. So they're very mobile. They're moving around where there's food. Perhaps the drought may have affected some of the food production in some areas. But what commonly happens this time of year is I'll get a call from one person saying, what happened to all the robins? And somebody else will call me and say, I've never had so many robins in my backyard in all the years I've lived here. So in the nesting season, the birds are kind of evenly distributed across the land in suitable habitat. As they flock up, now you've got large numbers in one area and very few somewhere else. And that's not uncommon for it. And as a caller earlier mentioned, too, the birds are not singing so much, so we don't get that morning music. And with that, the distribution of birds is such that they're now that flocking and moving, searching around for food.
And, thank you very much.
I'm sorry?
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Susan. Appreciate it very much. And I'm looking on my Facebook page, you know, lots of photos, bird photos here that are great. Martina sent us one. Maybe you can take a look at it, Bill. An identification one, but we'll. And let's see. Kathy sent one of a couple of baby hummers a week before they fledged.
Yeah, great.
Nest was at eye level, but 2 feet from their deck. That was Kathy in Denmark.
Always a good find.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other photo. Well, let's go to Judy and Kimberly. Judy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm about 20 miles south of Green Bay, and last week when I came out one morning, there must have been 15 to 20 ravens. We live along a park in a wood area, and I've never seen a raven before. I had to actually go to the bird book and look at it. And could you give me some information about ravens? And it looks as if they should not be in this area.
Yeah, we talk a lot about birds moving north in their range. Of course, the cardinal is the most spectacular one that we always cite, I think, on expanding northward, but there's a number of species that's doing that. But there are a few that are actually expanding southward. They're probably recolonizing areas that they used to be in. I think at one time ravens were spread throughout Wisconsin, but we're seeing a significant expansion of raven population southward in the state. There have been ravens in Door County, Kewaunee County in Brown County for a number of years, and we're starting to see greater numbers of them actually moving south, and there have been a few more sightings in the southern third of Wisconsin here in recent years. So it's something that for people that don't see ravens a lot, it's going to be fun to see how this expansion goes and enjoy them.
Yep. They were beautiful, and they were flying around and just awe-inspiring. Yep. And I'd never seen a raven before, so it was really incredible.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And Noah, Martina has up several photos of the bird that she thought.
Is that her bush tit?
Yeah, the bush tit.
I cannot see the photographs here.
I've got the photos here. I'm seeing a series of house wren pictures.
That's what I would guess.
Yeah, they're on the fence and adult feeding young. Those are house wrens. And then there's another picture posted here, and what I'm seeing is a a fall plumage or probably more of an immature magnolia warbler on a feeder.
Ah, yeah.
Somebody posted that. And that's a typical migrant for us coming from a little bit more of the northern part of the state, southern Canada, as they're now coming through.
All right.
And they're on their way all the way to Central America as well.
There we go. Dave in Fond du Lac. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in what good field guides to get that are realistic in color and have some descriptions of birds and especially game birds and waterfowl. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling. What are you guys recommending, Bill?
The Peterson guide is always a good kind of a standard. He's a good illustrator. Those are some nice pictures of the birds. That one, I think, works very well for people. They've also combined the Eastern and Western guides into one single guide. The Sibley guide has been very popular. It's very comprehensive. It shows a lot of variations of the plumage, so the different subspecies across the United States, immature plumages, and some of the variants that we might see. Those are good standards these days. National Geographic has a nice guide out. And, you know, some of them, you've got different illustrators with a little bit of a different artistic interpretation of the birds. Others are using photos, or Ken Kaufman actually digitally enhanced photos. I think the best thing to do is just go to a really big bookstore and thumb through some of them and take a look at the ones that just work well for you. Look at common birds and see if it's something that just illustrates for the way you look at birds some of the common ones very well. And just get a good book and use one book that you can start with so you know where to find some of these families of birds when you've got to quickly reference something. And take that, keep it with you, keep it handy. And once you've kind of memorized and worn out that book, then you can get something else and learn a little more from some other authors.
All right. That sounds like great advice to me. Let's go to David in Horicon. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to say a special hi to Bill. We live on the edge of the marsh in a wooded area, and I've got a little story about barred owls. We always like to listen to the barred owls calling at night. And but in addition to that, we one time had feral cats around our yard, and it bothered us because we have bird feeders out and whatnot. And this one particular mother would bring her brood out, and they would be playing around the yard, you know, which would bother the birds, you know, and it bothered us because we didn't like them around with our bird feeder. Well, one night we were listening to the barred owls, and we felt that they were very close to our area. Well, it seemed after that night we never saw the feral cats around anymore.
Oh.
Well, nice to hear from someone from Horicon. In fact, I'll be speaking in Mayville on Thursday. But for a barred owl, cat is a pretty large prey item.
These are youngsters.
Youngsters,
these were kittens.
Yeah, they could handle that. But for adults, great horned owls are big predators on cats.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's a kind of an easy, good food for them, as well as coyotes, which, as we've mentioned in past programs, is a good reason for cat owners to keep their cats indoors. It not only is safer for the birds, it's a lot safer for the cats as well. And, for young kittens, barred owls, that would certainly be a food source. They wouldn't distinguish one from another. If it's big enough to handle, it's food for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, David. Appreciate it. And Deborah and Brown Deer, hi.
Hi. Oh, I've been waiting for this show. I just love birds. And I just want to say, I think here's my recipe for people who like to watch birds: a cherry tree or a fruit tree, and a bird bath 10 feet away from it, and a pair of binoculars and a bird book. And I have seen so many birds at our at this bird bath that sparrows will come in, and then one will jump in, and then the other one will jump in, and there'll be like four in there at a time. And then the goldfinches, and then I saw something I thought was a cardinal earlier, like this month, and that's when the man called about the bird he thought was a cardinal, but it didn't have a tuft. I thought, I bet it was a crossbill, because I couldn't figure out what it was. I got my bird book out, and he would. But then again, now I'm confused, because I realize it was red, and the female is not red, but it would hop on the ground and dig, I think, grubs or worms out of the dirt, and feed its young on the pile of wood that we have under a spruce tree. And I read under cardinal just now that the mates will do that, with cardinal mates will do that. So anyway, there's a little downy wood, not a downy wood. Oh yeah, it is a downy woodpecker that nests in a little hole in a dead trunk. Mm-hmm. Of a birch tree, and so that's my other comment. Birds love dead trees, and I think people manicure their yards so much that there's no, like, they love dead branches and dead trees, and I watch them picking, all these different birds, picking the Japanese beetles off of the cherry tree.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I just love it.
My bird baths have been the most active this summer I can ever remember. We don't have, puddles around in the driveway or anything, and they've really been coming. My wife has been filling them up every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Same in our home, too. Thanks for calling, Deborah. Appreciate your call very much. We were talking about a gray-headed bird earlier with a parrot profile, guys, and Kathleen wondered if on our Facebook page if it could be a Quaker parrot, wondering if there's flocks of the species in Wisconsin. They've seen them in Florida, of course, when they lived in Naples.
Not to my knowledge, there are no flocks of them around.
Yeah, I think they're referring to what's called monk parakeet, which actually comes from Argentina, introduced into South Florida. There is a colony on the south side of Chicago, but I've never heard of them really moving or anything. What was referred to as that pink-sided junco, another possibility might be towhee. I want to check that. That's another possibility. They're a little darker, female's brown, the male's black. But somewhat of that pattern, that's another one that comes to my mind.
Reschel on Facebook was wondering, has the West Nile virus increased this year? And if so, is a bird feeder cleanliness a contributing or uncleanliness a contributing factor?
Well, as dry as it is, I'm assuming mosquitoes are down so much that West Nile must be down as well, since that's what's transmitting it. But now, bird feeders, the problem there is salmonella and bacterial diseases or fungus that builds up around the feeders, around the droppings, or in moist, molding food. West Nile is, of course, transmitted by mosquitoes. So those are really two different situations. But, yeah, keep your feeders clean for other reasons, other possible diseases.
And in the United States in general, this is an extremely high year for West Nile virus, but we're not seeing much of it or hearing much about it here in Wisconsin.
No, let's go back to that workshop you're being offered on grosbeaks galore.
Yes.
Tell us about that again.
It's being held on October 13th. The morning session is at the Country Inn and Suites in Port Washington in Ozaukee County. And then in the afternoon we'll be having field trips and exhibits and folks going around the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve, which is the old Squires Country Club golf course north towards Harrington Beach. And Bill's going to be our keynote speaker, and we have a whole bunch of nice speakers lined up to talk about what birds need and native trees and plants and how to take care of them and the hazards and how important Lake Michigan shoreland area is for migration. So it's our second annual. It's sponsored by about 8 or 9 organizations, and the fee is only $15, includes lunch. So.
And you go to, where do they go to get signed up for that?
WisconsinBirds.org. If you go to the main page, there's a little flyer right on that first page, and you just click on that and expand it, and you can get all the information on how to register from it.
And, Bill, you're speaking somewhere else again, too, aren't you?
I've got a number of speaking engagements. Some of them are open to the public, and some of them are for private organizations, for their members. All of those speaking engagements are posted on my website. So I've got a little calendar there as well, and usually when I can find a link for more information for a particular event that I'm at, people can just go there as well. So BillBunker.com is where I keep all of that.
Well, guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We've got links on my Facebook page to both of you, and so much appreciate. Looking forward to our next visit. Thanks, Noel. Thanks, Bill.
We always enjoy it.
All right. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our birding experts, they'll be back and do this all over again with us. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.